John F. Kennedy boasts the highest average approval ratings of any U.S. president of modern times, a 70% approval rating. And his time in office, it was short, but he was very beloved, and many may have forgotten what led him to his path of power and success. And today, in honor of Veterans Day, we'll be talking about that story, the story of the PT-109 shipwreck in which JFK proved his courage and leadership. Our guest today is William Doyle. William is the author of 10 books, including the latest, PT-109, An American Epic of War, Survival, and the Destiny of John F. Kennedy. He served as director of original programming for HBO. He's co-producer of the PBS special Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. And he joins us today from, wow, William, thank you for joining us. And you're a long ways from Wisconsin.
Yes, I'm in the beautiful country of Finland. I am on a Fulbright scholar. I am a Fulbright scholar here studying their magnificent public education system that achieves great results by doing mostly the opposite of everything we're doing in the United States. And I have an 8-year-old in a local school and am loving it a lot. So that's my next book. But the PT-109 book, it's very much a Veterans Day story, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful. And by the way, just before I forget, when you finish that book, please let us know. I would love to have you on to talk about that as well. But let's talk about PT-109 and John F. Kennedy. You have written a fascinating book. And kind of edge of your seat in many ways, but I have such a respect for John F. Kennedy after reading your book. He was a real hero, I think.
He was, according to the men who worked for him in World War II, and I actually found the last surviving PT boat veteran who worked directly under President and under John Kennedy's command, a fellow named John Klee, who lives in California. And he, like all the rest, will tell you that they practically adored John Kennedy because he was such a good man to work for and such a good leader in a small boat combat environment. But I think that he went to war as a playboy. College graduate, basically. That was all he had done. And when he came out of the war, he was a national pop culture icon action hero because there was a great article written about his PT-109 disaster in 1944, which made him briefly nationally famous. And you're right. Today, he is our most admired modern president among the American people. Mm-hmm. And that this one incident is what the PT-109 disaster is what propelled him into the Congress. It helped him get into the Senate. And I argue in my book that he used it as a critical weapon in his 1960 presidential campaign, mainly to eliminate Hubert Humphrey from the race and clear the path to him getting the nomination. It's a very important kind of a ripple event in American history. And I think it shows Kennedy probably at his finest, although some have accused him of negligence in the events leading up to the destruction of his own boat and the death of two crewmen, inches away from him in this incident.
It is really a fascinating read. And as you say, he was, and you start with him as a kind of a young man. I mean, obviously a very wealthy family and had all the advantages that anyone could have.
Well, yes, and to his great credit, his father engineered John Kennedy directly to get into the PT boat service because it would give him a boat command very, very early in his career, which normally you'd have to wait 20, 30 years for in the Navy. But the father said to the PT boat brass, essentially, keep my son away from, don't send him anywhere too dangerous. That was the wording he used. And John Kennedy, to his great credit, he sabotaged that idea and demanded to be placed on the very front edge of the hottest combat in the South Pacific at that moment, which was the Solomon Islands campaign. It was the follow-on from Guadalcanal and a vicious, you know, island by island struggle through the Solomons. He demanded to be put there. He was put there. And I think it shows you that, you know, the guy definitely had guts. He wanted to prove himself in combat. And the situation he was in, of course, well, you know, one question is why write a book about PT-109? Because it seems like a familiar story. I found a document that no one else has quoted at any length other than extraneous fragments. I found a document that John Kennedy wrote in 1946 about the disaster. It's an emotional document in his own voice that I found at the Kennedy Library, along with many, many, many other things that have never really been reported, where he talks about seeing one of his own men be nearly burned alive in this disaster, and how he had to take him and rescue him, and what the emotional impact was on him personally. And I think it transformed him from a fairly, you know, carefree action man into a seasoned combat leader, this whole event. And that document's never been published before. I published it in my book and you know, in full, and it's 12 pages. It's basically his account of the disaster, which, interestingly, he says he received a specific warning. He clears up a controversy in this event, in this new document written in 1946. He says that he received a specific radio warning of Japanese destroyers in his immediate area right in the 2 hours prior to the crash, which is ammunition for those who say he was negligent, because he had four of his men asleep on his boat, four of about a dozen. They were asleep or they were lying down. And one other PT boat skipper said if his commanding officer found any of his men asleep during a mission, that commanding officer would take out a pistol and kill him on the spot. So, you know, it's a measure both of Kennedy being a nice guy to an exhausted crew to allow them to sleep, and a measure of kind of a sloppy operational style that resulted in his boat being destroyed, two men being killed, and 11 men being stuck on the surface of the flaming ocean. You know, they're in pools of flaming gasoline without a boat anymore. They've got debris to hold on to after the boat, after the Japanese destroyer ran through them. They were lost and abandoned by their own American fellow PT boats, who thought that they had blown up and all hands were lost. They got out of there. But there were 11 survivors on the surface of the ocean. 1,200 feet below them was the ocean floor. They were in a shark-infested, a nighttime ocean environment with no rescue equipment, no boat, no guns, no food, no water, no way of getting home. And they're surrounded by enemy Japanese-held islands. That's what John Kennedy faced that night.
And there are so many things. I mean, the fact that he, the one person who was burned so badly, he actually took the guy, turned him on his back, and he had a life jacket on, but he took the strap in his teeth, as you report, and swam, what, 2-3 miles to the island?
It was over... Yeah, it was over 3 miles. Now, this is picture it. They're under the, if any of the Japanese spotters on Gizo Island or Kolombangara Island happened to swing the binoculars out to sea, they would have seen debris and they would have seen people on it. It's that close, easily spotted. Now, daybreak comes up. Three men are wounded out of the dozen, and one man is, you know, completely, terribly burned. So Kennedy decides to swim the whole group to a tiny speck of island out in the ocean, in the open ocean. And that 3 miles is longer than the longest Olympic swimming event ever held to that date. It was held once, by the way, I think in 1900, in the first decade of the 1900s, and they canceled it because people couldn't finish the swim. John Kennedy did that day with wounded people and towing another man who was terribly wounded, and they got to an island, and what did they realize? The island was a death trap because it had no food and no water, and they had no way of catching the millions of fish that were swimming just offshore. So now what do? They had to hide in the bushes so they weren't spotted by the Japanese. So, you know, John Kennedy embarked on a series of heroic, somewhat quixotic and highly dangerous solitary swims out into the open ocean and storming ocean to try to flag down help. So it's the ultimate trial, and the clock was ticking because the human body can go several weeks without food. It cannot go more than a few days without water because the body shuts down and dies very quickly, and that's what was happening to them. They had no water of any kind, and they were rescued in a remarkable series of kind of fluke events, and in the end, they were rescued by a veteran who is alive today, a U.S. Navy veteran who is 96 years old, by the name of William Bud Liebenow, who helped me tremendously with this book. He is 96 years old, one of the most critical players in the PT-109 saga, never told this story in great depth before, and he's the man who was John Kennedy's tent mate prior to the battle, his battle colleague during the battle, and he's the man who was given the very dangerous job of trying to go 40 miles behind enemy lines in the middle of the night with no radar on his boat and try to find John Kennedy on this remote jungle island and take and evacuate him and his men to safety. An incredible mission that he took me through minute by minute, what he was thinking, what he was doing, and the hazards that he faced.
And he's an amazing guy. I mean, he still exercises every day, if I remember rightly, from your book. And obviously a really sharp guy.
Bud Liebenow hits the gym and or the pool every day, and he remembers everything. And this book is largely his story in large part. And, I had the help of an amazing group of people. Ethel Kennedy, for example, who's never talked, I don't think she's talked to journalists or historians in any depth in over 40 years outside of her own family. She gave me much of a morning, telling me about a trip she took to Japan when she and her husband Bobby Kennedy in 1962 met the Japanese veteran, the destroyer commander who tried to kill John F. Kennedy, because he's the man who just gave the order to swing the boat directly into and crash and run over the PT boat. And that man they met in Tokyo. Bobby met in Tokyo. But Ethel told me very emotional stories of their journey to Japan. And the story continues to this day, of course, because, our current ambassador to Japan, the American ambassador, Caroline Kennedy, who actually gave me a photo of her father that's never been published outside the family that's printed in my book, in photo of her father in World War II, she, earlier this year, met the widow of the Japanese destroyer commander who tried to kill her father in Tokyo.
It is an amazing story. And the story of Bobby Kennedy and his reaction when he was confronted by Japanese students, and I want to get to that with you, William, too, because that in and of itself is an amazing, amazing story. We need to take a quick look at the news and the weather. And Mary in Madison, Phil in Hebron, Illinois, I hope you guys will stay on the phone and stay with us through the newscast. And as you listen and maybe have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We'll be back with William Doyle right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us on this Veterans Day when we celebrate the service of all U.S. military veterans. I think it's a day to reflect and appreciate their service. And we're reflecting upon an incident today that happened during World War II. Known as, and the author of the book is William Doyle. The title of his book is PT-109, An American Epic of War, Survival, and the Destiny of John F. Kennedy, reflecting on that particular incident and what it meant. And his thesis is that without the PT-109, he probably, most likely, would never have been our president. And again, William Doyle, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it very much. And I really enjoyed your book. And I just finished it a night ago. And I was so struck by so many things about the book, about John Kennedy, about his brother Bobby, too. And as we were breaking for news, you had been talking about Bobby Kennedy and his his visit to Japan. John Kennedy was always very interested in Japan after the war, and in meeting, he wanted to really meet the guy who captained the ship that ran over his PT-109 boat.
That's right. And he, John Kennedy tried in 1951, when he was not even a senator yet, he actually went to Tokyo at the tail end of an around-the-world trip with his brother Bobby, and he tried to find out where this Japanese veteran lived. And he was in the process of trying to arrange a meeting with this man when, after several days in Tokyo, John Kennedy fell suddenly deathly ill with 106-degree fever, which can kill you in a matter of hours, and he had a collapse of his adrenal glands from the Addison's disease, and he was medevaced out to Okinawa, where they U.S. military hospital, where they gave him his last rites. He recovered from that, but he always had this dream of, literally a dream of going back to Japan, and he was planning that when he was killed. And in advance of the trip, he sent his brother Bobby and wife Ethel, who I interviewed for this book, to Tokyo to lay the groundwork. And there's a great, great American moment that Americans, most Americans, don't know nothing about. When Bobby Kennedy, representing our nation as Attorney General, and his brother, stepped into an auditorium at a university called Waseda University in Tokyo, which was in total chaos. Thousands of students in a hall were basically on the verge of rioting. They were throwing chairs at each other. There were hecklers, communist agitators, anti-war agitators. And Bobby Kennedy has no guards because this was a campus where security was not allowed. It was a tradition. And instead of take off, I'm sorry?
It's an amazing story you're about to tell here.
Well, okay, so the entire nation of Japan is watching on live television that's just been connected with the little, you know, early Sony TV sets. My parents-in-law, by the way, who are Japanese, remember this moment. They were young newlyweds at the time, and they remember this night. All of Japan is watching. The lights are cut off in this auditorium. Fights are breaking out, and Bobby Kennedy and his pregnant wife are defenseless up on the stage. What does Bobby Kennedy do? He invites the lead heckler up onto the stage. He says, come on up. You have something to say. Come on up here. Let people hear what you have to say. And he holds the microphone for this kid as he screams and yells at Bobby Kennedy for about 20 minutes, politely holds the microphone. And then more chaos. And Bobby Kennedy thought to himself, you know, I think the TV feed is still working, even though the lights are off in this auditorium. And he kept talking. He stood his ground. And he grabbed the bullhorn, and, you know, he eventually won the crowd over by saying things that, you remember his 1968 campaign, when his campaign rhetoric was like poetry. It was the greatest rhetoric, you know, any American politician has ever issued on the campaign trail. He started doing that kind of rhetoric in Tokyo that night, and this has never been broadcast in the United States, but I found the tape in the Japanese archives. And Kennedy ends the speech by saying something like, we stand on the age of greatness is before us, and the only way we can make our world a better place for our children is if we work together as brothers. And in that moment, Japan went completely over to his side, and the rest of his trip through Japan was a victory march and a triumph for America.
Oh, it is a wonderful story that you tell of that. And Mary in Madison's been waiting a while. I want to give Mary a chance and then Phil from Hebron. But Mary, first, what's on your mind?
Well, I just recently watched a JFK American Experience program on PBS. And in the course of that program, it was mentioned that at the time that the PT-109 Kennedy ship was or boat was hit, that it was standing motionless in the water. And then the destroyer hit it broadside. And I was just wondering, did they have any awareness that the ship was bearing down on them? Was it ever discovered why they were? First of all, I guess, is that an accurate?
William Doyle has a thank you, Mary. William has those minutes very well chronicled in his book. William, want to talk about that?
Yeah, the boat was on patrol, more or less stationary, but moving forward at a few miles an hour. The boat that hit them was coming anywhere from 25 to 30 plus knots. So the and Kennedy had four of his men asleep out of the dozen or laying down on the boat, and they should have been up watching with binoculars in all directions. So there was no time for him to react, really. The collision was a fluke, one-in-a-million occurrence. I don't think anything like this happened in World War II exactly like this. That's true. And the Japanese, I tell a lot of the Japanese side of the story. I found accounts of men who were on the Japanese destroyer who were burned by gasoline that flew up from the PT-109 and fell on their deck. And they were tumbling out of their watch stations on the upper parts of the boat. And the captain of that, or the commander on the Japanese destroyer, saw the PT-109 at the last second and thought to himself, I can ram it and run it over. And he swerved very hard to do that, and he hit a bullseye right in the middle of the front part of the boat.
Wow.
Amazing. Amazing story. Thanks, Mary. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I think the author already answered my question whether he could have been elected president without PT-109, but I just want to tell him my dad was a World War II vet, and he's a lifelong Republican, and he voted for Kennedy, and that's why he voted for him. But my real question is, he was medevaced for Addison's disease. Was he ever symptomatic before that, and did they actually diagnose Addison's disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Addisonian crisis, or the Addisonian condition, was diagnosed in 1947. And what happened to Kennedy in Tokyo was he didn't have enough medicine with him, and he had been worn down. It may not have been 47. It was a few years later. But in Tokyo, he had been worn down by the rigors of an around-the-world trip, and he didn't have enough medicine with him, and that's why he fell on into the gates of death there. And the Addison's condition was rumored over the years. He denied it in the 1960 campaign in a way that was disingenuous or a lie, depending on how lenient you are with these things. But it was a life-threatening condition.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. Just going back to the PT-109, somebody asked, what is PT? What does PT stand for? And it's patrol torpedo, isn't it?
That's right, patrol torpedo. These were 80-foot-long weaponized speedboats that were supposed to be spread around key parts of the South Pacific theater and also a bit in Europe. And they were multi-purpose. They would interdict and harass enemy shipping with fast torpedo attacks, although that didn't work very well because the torpedoes stunk until late in 1943. They were a joke. They never hit anything. They also could land spies or troops or supplies at night and rescue downed flyers. They were good at that. So the good thing about a PT boat was you got to command your own boat when you were 22, 23 years old, like Bud Liebenau and John Kennedy did, and that was a big plus.
Absolutely. And the night of the attack, there were several boats, PT boats, operating in that arena.
Yeah, some people think that they think, oh, PT-109, he was out on patrol by himself somewhere and got run over. It actually was, he was one boat out of 15 PT boats who were attempting one of the largest mass PT torpedo boat attacks of World War II. They were trying to ambush a four-destroyer convoy, fast-moving, of the Japanese Navy, nicknamed the Tokyo Express, which was trying to shoot down through a passage, drop troops and supplies off, really fast, like throwing them overboard quick, and then get out of there fast and get back to their super base at Rabaul. All of this was happening right where my very close to where my father was stationed in New Guinea at that time, too. So he had very vivid memories he always shared with me about that time. But they were supposed to attack and sink some of these destroyers. They shot 30-plus torpedoes. Kennedy did not, but his fellow picket line, the other PT boats in the picket line did. All 30 PT torpedoes missed, as they always did in mid-1943 and earlier, and usually did. And the Japanese were hightailing it out of there when, at the last minute, they saw this target of opportunity, which was John Kennedy in his boat drifting around with four guys asleep on it. Now, you can argue who was negligent in the lead-up to this. He also had two of his three engines cut out, but there's an argument for that, because then you can hear the approach of Japanese torpedo planes easier, and you don't leave as much of a wake of bubbles behind you. So that's, you know, that's understandable. It's debatable whether or not he should have done that. But and they, you know, they run him over. But what's not debatable is that was he a hero in the 7 days afterwards? Because the American government gave him a life-saving medal for saving one man and helping keep together the rest, that had the word hero in it. So officially, you know, he was a hero, and his men thought he was a great leader in this terrible life and death ordeal, and his men are the ones that I rely on, and I think he proved something, you know, really great about himself, as he was capable of being a leader. And like I said, today the American people consider him the best of all the modern presidents. I think it's because they sense that leadership in him for all his faults and his humanity and his imperfections, but I think he had some great leadership secrets I don't see many politicians having today, one of them being humility, candor, telling the truth, and admitting that you have made a mistake, which he was always very comfortable doing, unlike anybody I know of in modern American politics.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And he did after that. Now, he could have, when he was saved and could have sort of spent the rest of the war behind a desk, maybe, but he volunteered to go back out.
Oh, yeah. And also, to his great, great credit, he earned a ticket back home to the life of, you know, playboy gazillionaire without any question. That was the tradition. You lost your boat, you went home. He demanded to be kept in the combat zone for another, it was 4 months, and in that period, the men of his new boat, the PT-59, were afraid that he had, in the words of one of them, gone crazy was the word he used, because Kennedy wanted to pay back the Japanese. He wanted to attack Japanese in high-risk daylight raids in very dangerous conditions. And some of his men said, I don't want to go out with this guy. He's gone a little crazy, and his plans make no sense. We're going to get killed. And instead of paying back the Japanese by killing Japanese, guess what John Kennedy manages to do? He rescues 10 Marines who are being chased into the ocean by Japanese infantry on another jungle island. He swings his boat in between them. The Marines get picked up and lifted into Kennedy's and another rescue boat, and they are saved. This is 10 lives that John Kennedy saved that he never talked about again. He got no medals for, but that's because he demanded to be kept in the combat zone, and he eventually got sent home because his commander said, you know, you're about to die, you're so sick and thin, so just get out of here, go home and rest up, which he eventually did. He was eventually, you know, discharged for medical reasons.
Amazing. Jill and Racine, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I still respect President Kennedy. I think he may have, so far he's been the greatest president I've ever lived with. And it's not about my father, but my father was 19 at Pearl Harbor. We were in some of the same places that President Kennedy was. I think the strength of his family is inspiring. I read an article that Maria and a couple of her brothers still spend summers together. Mm-hmm. The background you grew up in gave him some of his strength. He had a large family. there was a regrettable mistake with one sister. But his background, his family, I'm sure must have inspired him to give him the strength to do what he did.
Thank you for calling, Jill. A comment, William?
Well, yeah, I think the shining star in John Kennedy's life, as it is in mine, was his father. And in my case, it's my father and my mother, to a great extent. And, you know, he was very much his father's son, but he also moved out of the shadow of his father and his older brother as well. But, you know, John Kennedy had a nephew named Max Kennedy, who is in his late 50s today. He gave me a most wonderful interview because Max Kennedy and John F. Kennedy Jr., John F. Kennedy's son, had always talked about going back to the Solomon Islands and diving for the wreck and thanking the men who saved his father, the local Solomon Islands natives. John F. Kennedy Jr. never got to do that because he died. But Max Kennedy did. In 2002, he went back to the Solomon Islands, and he met the now elderly gentleman who had rescued his uncle in an emotional family reunion that is one of the most moving things I ever heard. And Max told me all about that, and it's toward the end of my book, and I think it brings home exactly what the caller is talking about the strength of family and what that means to people. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Jill, for that. And friendship. I mean, he actually, in some ways, became friends, even though he never met the guy. He became friends with the guy who ran him over. I mean,
that's right. Kohei Hanami, who became the mayor of his little town in Japan, and John Kennedy held a very affectionate brotherly correspondence over the years, and they always wanted to meet each other, and they would congratulate each other on children being born and marriages and elections. This Japanese fellow helped John Kennedy get into the Senate because he endorsed him for Senate by long distance, and that was published in Time magazine and the Boston papers, and it was milked for all they could get by the Kennedy campaign, saying, hey, we have a candidate who's a statesman. He reconciles with his former enemy. It's amazing. Now, that may not have been decisive in beating Lodge. I think Lodge beat himself in 1952. But in 1960, John Kennedy used PT-109 as a dirty trick against Hubert Humphrey because the Kennedy campaign accused Humphrey of being a draft dodger, and Humphrey was winning that primary until they started doing that and pulling the patriotism button on Humphrey. Humphrey got beat and quit that night in disgust and despair the night of the West Virginia primary, which opened up the path for controversially Catholic, until that moment, John Kennedy to be ratified by the Protestant voters of West Virginia. The road was clear for him to seize the Democratic nomination in 1960. It was all because of the symbolic marketing use of PT-109, this one lost, incredibly dramatic incident from World War II, which affects the world, the country we live in today, because like you said, Kennedy was very consequential in that brief period of his presidency. He grappled with civil rights and race relations, which we do today, with Russia, which we do today, with the nuclear issue. He launched us into space, which we deal with every day. So he's kind of a gatekeeper of American history, he has Bill Clinton over to the Rose Garden, then John Kennedy calls up Herbert Hoover on the telephone and Harry Truman, and he kind of straddles a lot of eras, and in the end, it was all because of this controversial single incident that he was lucky enough, somebody else wrote a classic article about, that his father then, reproduced by the millions and gave to all the voters, and it made the case for him. He didn't have to run around saying, I'm a war hero. That was his origin story, and it was kind of sanctified by that classic New Yorker article from 1944.
It's a great story, and it's a wonderful book. I really, really enjoyed it. I learned so much from it, and I want to thank you so much for... Did you ever see one of the PT-109 pins that they used in the presidential election, by the way?
Oh, yes. In fact, my editor, my great editor at HarperCollins, William Morrow, Peter Hubbard, has one of those pins in his personal family collection, and he let us take a picture of that for our book. That pin's in our book.
William, thank you again. I so much enjoyed your book, and I hope it's doing well.
It is. It's gotten great reviews. It's selling well, and I hope people discover the story, because I think it's a good American story. And you know, sometimes it makes you sometimes in the book, I think, quite proud to be an American.
And absolutely.
That was my goal. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, William. William Doyle is the author, and the book is PT-109, An American Epic of War, Survival, and the Destiny of John F. Kennedy. We have a link. Certainly it's available at any bookstore or online. We have a link on our Facebook page if you want to learn a little bit more about the book. But I'm telling you, it is a fascinating read, and I truly enjoyed it. And it's great to talk about it, especially on this Veterans Day. Well, I want to thank you so much for listening. A happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans who are listening in today. And please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.